idea how these things should be done, but
they should be done by breaking the rules.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Can you get a
boss area someplace?
Just start that again.
Sure. I was just saying the only time that I've ever heard Helen lose her cool on tape. But she was doing an interview with a gentleman who had a team of oxen. So she was finding out about the various calls for oxen and the various superstitions and things like that. And all of a sudden you heard this, there's a rat! And you could hear the microphone drop and bang. She was in this barn and the rat went by. Helen has a fear of rats. So when Mr. Rat came out to investigate, she just dropped the microphone and took off. And then she recovered very nicely and got the microphone back and continued on with the interview.
Seems about the only thing she was afraid of. Rats.
Well, it's interesting because she will quite often comment on how after an evening of listening to all these ghost stories and things like that, and especially, this was of course the days when there were no lampposts around in the early 20s and 30s in Nova Scotia, very few paved roads, and quite often she had to go to isolated farmhouses, and she'd be leaving their place at 11 or 12 o'clock at night and driving down the farmhouse, and then all of a sudden she'd come to the crook of the road where the headless woman was supposed to have been seen, and she just heard the story, and she said, she often told me and tells me that she said a good many times the foot went down on the accelerator a little heavier as she sped by that place.
Are we doing any kind of introduction for Clary? Is that going to be edited in?
So we can do, just talk. But I think it would be helpful maybe if you could just... would you mind just saying,
no.
I'm Clary Crofton for several years.
You want some biographical.
If you don't mind, let's do it that way. And
that would be nice.
It would give us the choice of using that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Or,
for instance, there was a thing where Helen spoke about how you came to her after already singing these songs for about 7 years, mm-hmm. so you could maybe start there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so you're yeah. All right. My name is Clary Croft, and I guess I'm sort of somewhat of a regional specialist in the Creighton Collection. My first interest in the Creighton Collection, of course, is because I grew up with traditional music myself, and unwittingly I had learned several songs from the Creighton Collection, and then I was working for the government down in Sherbrooke Village Restoration, doing folkloric research, and I needed some more material, and I knew that Dr. Creighton would have this material, so I called her up and introduced myself and said, I'm looking for material specifically from my area, thinking that she might have three or four songs that came from my area. So she said to give her a couple of days, and in a few days in the mail, I got a list three or four pages long of almost 200 songs on this list, so I thought, now this is a wonderful woman to know, so I called up and invited myself over, actually. Well, she invited me over, but I said, I'd love to meet you. So I went over, and we became fast friends. And she, just as I was leaving, she said, would you like to sing for me? So I thought this might be the big test. So I stood up in her beautiful old parlor at Evergreen, where she formerly lived, and sang a song for her. And when it was all over, she said, you'll do just fine.
So how long is your... You've had a long-standing relationship now, and you've worked on the archives yourself.
Yes, I guess I've known Helen personally for close to 17 years now. And then in 1983, I was the contract archivist from 1983 to 19... No, it wasn't 1983. It was 1986 to 1988. I was the contract archivist for her collection. She donated her entire private folklore collection to the Public Archives of Nova Scotia, and I was chosen to put that collection from its private perspective into an archival perspective. It was a big job. Still haven't got it all done.
I bet it was a big job. I wanted to ask you one question, which is something you brought up earlier, that an archive could be looked at in two ways. One is in a historical document, as a library for musicologists or for people with literary interests, or it could be used as a repository of songs that are a living tradition. And I gather that you're interested in the latter as much as the former.
Well, I don't think that you can differentiate between the two. The fact that something is part of our cultural heritage and part of our roots, so to speak, since that is a reasonably popular term, means that we are the custodians of it at present, and it's up to us to take as much care as we possibly can. My other field, of interest is in the costume and textile field, and there you're quite often dealing with material artifacts. And I consider to be the study of folklore to be the same way. It doesn't have to be something tangible that you can reach out and touch, but it's up to us to keep as in good condition and to keep it alive and keep it prospering, the folkloric beliefs that we have, which also include ghost stories, superstitions, cures, remedies, tall tales, and the vast corpus of folk music that she's collected.
Now, you take this to schools yourself, and you perform them, and do you tell the stories as well?
Oh, sure. I do a lot of work in the public school systems, and sometimes it's as in services with teachers, and sometimes, quite often, I really enjoy doing it with the children themselves in the classroom. And several times teachers have said to me, oh, you should put this on video. It would be wonderful. I shouldn't put it on video. Mm-hmm. There's enough time that they sit in front of a television screen and have something coming at them that they can't bounce off. And I have them involved. It's when you go to a school and the teacher says, now Mr. Croft is here, he's going to sing folk songs for you. And their immediate response is either, oh, we're going to learn hey diddle 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 whoop de whoop de doo, or there's going to be something so foreign to us that we don't understand it. Well, the first song I sing for them is a song about a boy and a girl who fall in love. And they can't make a go of it because the girl's parents can't stand the boy. Well, there's nothing historic about that. So all of a sudden you're dealing with something on their level. And then when you start talking about superstitions, good or bad luck, cures, remedies, how things are passed on through the oral transmission process, they're still doing it today. So if you can make it relevant to them, then all of a sudden they're thinking, hey, I really enjoy this stuff. I think I'm going to explore it more. I've had more kids come up to me afterwards and say, I'm going to go to the library now and get out a couple of Helen Creighton books. Or my uncle sings some of those old songs, and I think I'm going to learn them now. Or I'm going to read a Helen Creighton story, and then I'm going to make up a poster about it. When you get that kind of interest and that kind of enthusiasm, that's what being live in the classroom can do.
Mm. Yes.
Not a videotape.
You said the oral tradition is still being passed on, and I was I'm wondering how. I see how you do it, but how is it being done elsewhere? No, it's in the field, so to speak.
Well,
you know, out in the country.
No, not just in the country. The field of folklore is not the study of old material. Mm-hmm. It is the study of cultural material that is passed on through the process of oral transmission or customary example. We're using it every day of our lives. How do we know, how do we recognize people's thoughts? How do we recognize people's attitudes? Is it through body language? Are we passing on bits of information through things like computer lore, computer graphics? Are we passing on bits of information by these jokes and riddles and things that tend to, it's called photocopy folklore, that tend to go on and you say, well, where did that come from? It's passed on through this transmission process. We're constantly using the process of oral transmission. The most blatant example of that everybody can really attune to is the phenomenon known as the urban legend or the urban myth. And the most common one of that is, of course, the gruesome babysitter story of the babysitter who gets high on LSD and puts the baby in the microwave oven instead of the turkey. We've all heard versions of that. Or the lady who has a beehive hairdo and just keeps hairspraying it and has hairsprayed it for so long that the spiders eat into her head. People tell those stories as facts, and they tend to read them in places like the National Enquirer, but they're passed on by word of mouth so rapidly, especially among young people, junior high school level. They're quite often referred to as babysitter stories. Or, in fact, an American folklorist, Jan Harald Brunvand, has a couple of books out. One is called The Choking Doberman, which is, again, another great urban myth. And The Vanishing Hitchhiker, which is perhaps the most famous of the hitchhiker who picks up somebody on the road, and she tells the story and is let out, and he goes to the door because she's left a sweater or a jacket or something in the back seat, and they said, oh, that's Mary's jacket, but she was killed on the highway 3 years ago this very night. We're still passing on those bits of oral lore. We're still passing on customary example. We're still passing on examples of how we cure with remedies. You don't have to go to a doctor book to find out that a good many people in their home have the aloe vera plant. all those things are passed on.
Yes.
So we're still using them to a great extent. The study of folklore is not the study of old things.
And it's not removed from our culture.
Not removed from our culture, because anybody, whether they be a university professor or whether they be somebody who still has the unfortunate circumstance in Canada of being illiterate, still has those same kinds of beliefs, and they pass them on. They may be on a different level, on a different social strata, but our folkloric beliefs are quite human.
But you are making an effort to pass on a certain kind that... You know, it's interesting. We may not put this on the tape because the question won't come out right, but I got the impression when I was talking to Helen Creighton that it wasn't so much that this tradition is being passed on, in fact, at all. It was a very private thing. It was sung within the family. It wasn't performed on platforms, and that wasn't the purpose of it. And now they don't seem to need it, she said, in one way or another, because they have radio or television, you know?
Yes,
what I'm getting to is that it still seems to me that you're making an effort to pass something on of a particular nature.
I think what I'm trying to do, the study of folklore, Helen is indeed a phenomenal folklorist, and she's a pioneer, but her background is in the field of pioneering folklore. She's not tremendously knowledgeable on contemporary folklore, understandably so, because that's not her field. Her field is the Helen Creighton Collection, and that is big enough to keep anybody busy. My interest is in all the fields of folklore, but we have one of the most valuable collections in the world here, which is the Helen Creighton Collection. So why not use that to our best advantage? So if you're going to try to teach people how relevant folkloric beliefs are in our contemporary society, why not start with something that is most important to us, and that's our background. It's like English language. You don't want to teach somebody nowadays to write in the style of William Shakespeare or John Milton, but you want to give them the background material. You want to give people an appreciation of that kind of material. So therefore, you're moving in those same circles with the field of folklore. I want people to be interested in the Creighton Collection, but I want them to also move beyond the Creighton Collection and realize that they have their own folklore. If, for instance, you go to the Creighton Collection and find out that people have all sorts of ways of establishing what is good or bad luck, we still have that today. We still have people who... all of us have something that we will do, whether it be sports heroes who will not change their number. Or why do you think that they retire a number? Because it's bad luck to have somebody else's number. Or certain kinds of cries and rallies that you have with a sports team. Certain kinds of office in-jokes, that sort of thing. It's all passed on through the process of oral transmission. It makes one feel part of a particular cultural group. Now, years ago, the cultural family was more isolated, and therefore you had the dissemination between a smaller cultural family. Nowadays, we're having a larger cultural family, but we all still fall into folk groups, whether it be through our religious beliefs, or whether it be through our moral aspects. It all falls into a folk group, ethnic background.
That's interesting. So what you're saying is that folklore is still very much with us. It's just the particular forms are different, or sometimes they're more disguised, or they're not disguised, but they're just very different from what we've commonly thought folklore to be.
They're just different.
So we're all automatically passing this on.
Sure, because if, say for instance, a folklorist looking at the material, if there was a folklorist around who was able to collect material before Helen Creighton went out into the field and collected it, they would find that material quite different than what Helen collected.
Because it changed so much.
Of course.
It changes within the decade or within a year even.
For instance, I recently presented a paper in Lunenburg on the folkloric beliefs of witchcraft in Lunenburg County. Now, when Helen Creighton was collecting folkloric beliefs of witchcraft in Lunenburg County, the belief was still relatively strong, but it was sort of the kind of belief that people said, yes, it might be so. But had you collected the same kinds of beliefs 100 years previous to that in Lunenburg County, people would have said, yes, it is so. They would actually point out somebody and say, that person is a witch. I will do this. I will do that to prevent witchcraft. The people that I that came up to me and spoke to me after I presented my paper that came from Lunenburg County said, yes, I've heard those stories, but they're passed on more as our oral history as opposed to our belief. But we all have this recessive trait in our psyche that we tend to draw a fine line between what is, or there tends to be a gray line between what is our actual belief and what is something that is sort of instilled in us. How many of us will say something like, oh, I hope I get this job, and knock on wood, knowing that it probably isn't going to mean anything, but it is customary. It's a customary example thing that they do. And again, how you perceive it to be valid or how you perceive it to be real is also a big part of how, the interest that I feel in it. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that we really don't have a lot of, and I think Helen is right in this, in that television and radio, and certainly the electronic media has helped to get rid of a lot of it, is passing on various traditional musical forms, because they tend to be more stratified. People tend to get them in one form, and then they do it, and people will actually learn a form of music. Somebody will say, well, I like blues, so I'm going to sing in a blues style. Where before, people sang in a style that was part of their community, and it was expected that way, and therefore they passed on that style, but those styles changed. When you start listening to the early material on the Creighton tape, some of the early material that she did when she was actually cutting her own records in the field, after a while, after I was listening to it, I could distinguish the older singing styles from the more contemporary styles that she started to collect in the 40s and 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. Their singing style changed drastically.
That's interesting. And from community to community, the style was different?
Community to community, from father to son, mm-hmm. from mother to daughter, the mm-hmm. style was different.
I see.
You could, when, say for instance, somebody like...
could you illustrate that? Is it possible? I realize
no,
that
no, because I'm not a traditional singer. But yeah. But for instance, if you can imagine somebody like Ben Henneberry, who used mm-hmm. to live on Devil's Island and right. was one of Helen's most important informants, Ben was a real old traditional singer. He sang with a very straightforward style. His son Edmund, who was also a wonderful traditional singer, had access to listening to contemporary, at his point in time, contemporary radio. So from my perspective, I can hear just a hint of that country and western influence brought into his singing style, which is not there in his father Ben's. And then later on, in some of the recordings that Helen Creighton did in the 40s and 50s, you get quite country and western influence. So it really does change demonstratively. Also, the ballad singing style. An old time singer of a ballad, say a child ballad, which is the oldest ballad form that we have here in Nova Scotia, would sing a song like Geordie, which is, again, an old ballad, a child ballad. And he'd probably, I'm trying to think of the first verse of Geordie, as I walked over London Bridge on a misty morning early. That song has a lot of verses. It would take me probably about 20 minutes to sing that song that way. But the ballad singer was in no hurry. There was no restrictions. There wasn't anybody on the other end of the radio saying, 5 seconds, Mr. Henneberry. Mr. Henneberry could take as long as he wanted to tell that story. And at times, they would even stop. One of her wonderful informants in Middle River, Lunenburg County, Nathan Hatt, would start to sing a song, and he'd stop, and he'd say, oh, she was a lovely girl. And he would explain a little bit about her, and then he'd stop, and he'd do an interjection. They were really our storytellers, the same way that we now look at something like a dynasty, and we spin stories, and we spin these imaginative tales around it. That's what they were doing, except I think they did it a lot better. They had such magic. And a good traditional singer could hold you spellbound through 80-odd verses of a long ballad. And people in the audience would be crying when the body was washed up on shore, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful thing to hear. But what I've had to do is look at that material and say, we are not in that same context in our contemporary society. Very few people are willing to sit down and listen to that singing style. I'm not terribly interested in doing that singing style. I have my own singing style, which is not a traditional singing style. It's more of a folk song revivalist singing style. So I interpret the songs for a contemporary audience. So when people hear me sing, they quite often say to me, oh, well, it's good to hear the traditional songs being sung the way they were. Sorry, that's not true. You know, yes. I'm not a traditional singer. I was brought up with traditional music, and I first learned to sing in that style, partially. But I was also brought up with a lot of organ music and sitting around and singing anything and everything that came in. You get into the parlor. Which is the other thing, again, with the traditional singers, that Helen Creighton would never ask an informant to sing a folk song. Because they would have no way of differentiating between the old Oaken Bucket, Put My Little Shoes Away, or Geordie. They were all old songs. Some of the older traditional singers would say, now here's a real old one, now this is a lovely old song. And not something that they learned from a piece of sheet music of 1910 or whatever.
Right, yes. She said they called them old-time songs.
Old-time songs. Right. Yeah, as opposed to the more current songs that they would have learned from sheet music, and once people started to get pianos or pump organs and things like that, and the kinds of songs that they would hear on the radio. Sometimes songs that they would hear in music halls in vaudeville that was around Nova Scotia at the time. And there was a lot of music halls around Nova Scotia, and quite often there was an awful lot of performers who would come and sing songs. And sometimes they would learn them. And then they would fall into the oral transmission process.
Yes, I see.
Because they would be passed on from one person to the next.
It's very interesting. Maybe we should talk a little bit about the songs themselves. Where were we with?
I had mentioned earlier Geordie.
Right.
Geordie is a good example because it's the oldest style of song that comes from the Helen Creighton collection.
Meaning what?
Well, it's classified as a child ballad. There are 304 or 306, I'm not quite sure of the number, child ballads. These were ballads that were considered to be the creme de la creme of British balladry that were collected by Professor James Child. And he published these, he was a professor out of Boston. And he published these in the latter part of the 19th century. And these became to be known as really the most choice, the best British ballads. And we have 30-odd here in Nova Scotia that were brought over. And a lot of the ballads date from the Middle Ages, of course, because that's the time that they were conceived. And the bards and the troubadours were passing these stories on from one person to the next. To get the traditional singers talking about these and not perhaps singing a country and western song, Helen Creighton couldn't come right out and say, well, do you know a child ballad? Well, how could they know a child ballad if they weren't categorized, or they weren't even calling them that? They're calling them old time songs. So she would say, well, now, do you know a song about a milk white steed? And quite often a child ballad has a milk white steed. There's an awful lot of these stock phrases. Geordie has the milk white steed.
Right.
If somebody wears a gown, it's quite often a green silken gown. I'll sing Geordie for you. It's a lovely, lovely, lovely old ballad song.
As I walked over London Bridge on a misty morning early, it was there I spied with a pretty fair maid all lamenting for her Geordie. What has he done? Who has he killed? Has he murdered anybody? No, he stole 5 pearls from the royal's crown, and he sold them in a hurry. Go bring to me my milk-white steed, go saddle up my pony, £500 I will lay down, all to plead for the life of Geordie. Well, the judge, he looked over his right shoulder, It was words he did say plenty. Prepare yourself for death, young man, for its mercy shan't have any. Then the judge, he looked over his left shoulder. It was words he did say plenty. I'm afeard you've come too late, fair maid, for your loved one is judged already. Well, if I had my Geordie on yonder's plain, it would be kisses I'd have plenty. With a sword and a pistol by my side, I'll fight for the life of Geordie.
Now, as I said earlier, my singing style is quite different than what you would hear from a real traditional singer. One of the things that's interesting with a lot of the traditional Nova Scotian music is, it's also interesting with a lot of the traditional North American music, is the use of grace notes. So, for instance, if somebody was singing, as I walked over London Bridge, the more traditional singer would go, as I walked over London Bridge. So they put more trills and frills in it. And sometimes the traditional singers put so many trills and frills in it that it just became an exercise in how embellished you could make the song.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think that tradition comes from? Is that a Scottish tradition?
It's an English-Scottish tradition. It's certainly an embellishment. What it meant to serve, it gave the... it gave the singer a chance to play with the melody, and if they were an exceptionally good singer, to make themselves sound even better. It's part of a flourish. It's part of a technique. It's when you watch a great violinist, they have a wonderful body technique and a wonderful body language, and they have a wonderful flourish that they sometimes will give the bow an extra little twist. Mm-hmm. And it actually does give the music an extra little twist, and that's what the traditional singer does.
Now, we were talking about Phoebe before, right? That's a cappella.
Bright Phoebe.
Bright Phoebe.
Well, most of the traditional folk songs were sung unaccompanied.
Nice.
The singer never had to worry about whether or not they had a guitar or a banjo or an accordion or whatever, primarily because these songs were not just entertainment songs. They were songs that were very much a part of their everyday lives. Nowadays, if you're going to be working around the house or maybe raking the leaves in the garden or something, you'll turn the music on or put a Walkman on for even that and walk around with a headset because you enjoy the music and you enjoy it. I always say to the kids at school, you if somebody tells you to clean up your room, you tend to put the Ghetto Blaster on with Iron Maiden or something and you bop around the room and you clean it up. Well, people used to do exactly the same thing. They enjoyed their music so much that they would work with it. They would, if somebody was going to be plowing a field, old Nathan Hatt, he used to walk his oxen back and forth to the woods, and that's where he retained most of his songs. He would sing to his oxen all day long. So the traditional singers didn't feel that the songs were something that were only to be brought out and dusted off for entertainment.
Yes.
They were really a very intrinsic part of their everyday life, and they lived with them, and they became friends with them.
I was going to ask you, don't you think that some of the songs seem specifically related to the activities they were doing?
Oh,
so it's
yes.
A little bit different from putting on your Walkman. You would actually sing a song about what it was that you were doing at the moment.
To a certain extent, yes. There were certainly songs that were used aboard vessels, and there were certainly things like fulling songs. There's a wonderful fulling song from Cape Breton. It's a... She Cape Breton timu grai, tin and grooch brown nar, she Cape Breton timu grai, tir at sart or linex salon. And the translation is Cape Breton is the land I love, land of lakes, of mighty mountains, Cape Breton is the home for me. Loveliest land in all the wide world. Well, that particular song has tons of verses, and if you're going to be working at a Scottish milling frolic in Cape Breton, that is preparing the cloth and fulling it or fluffing it up, mm-hmm, after it was woven on the loom, you would gather around a table and sing that song, and it actually did have a specific purpose. But quite often, like nowadays, you daydream about a story or about a song, or you can sit down and read a book. You entertain yourselves by thinking about wonderful stories. Like Phoebe has a wonderfully sad story, but it's still a nice song. I'll sing it for you.
Great, wonderful.
As I walked out one evening fair to view the fields and to take the air, I heard a young man sigh and say, I've lost my darling Phoebe. Bright Phoebe was my true love's name. She has my tender heart inflamed. Where could you find a fairer dame if you search the wide world over? Her parents, they were all agreed that married quick lie we would be. As soon as I return from sea to seal that solemn bargain. Before I had returned from sea, they had my sport and companion slain. The pride and glory shone around, in the cold clay lay mouldering. I am forlorn, I am forlorn. I wish that I had ne'er been born. I die where billows loudly roar, since fortune's proved so cruel. I'll go on to some distant place, where I will see no human face, and spend the remainder of my days lamenting for my Phoebe. That's a nice, sad story. And people could actually imagine what the characters were like. I think we're missing some of that nowadays. I hate to sound like an old fogey, but it's... You've often heard people say, yes, but I like the book better. And quite often they like the book better because they could imagine people as they painted the pictures themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's what people were able to do. They were able to romanticize and paint the pictures themselves and come up with some phenomenal ideas as to what the people were really like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The melody of that song is so much like Greensleeves, but the first part of it must be difficult to sing and not go into the other.
Well,
that's an aside, by the way.
Well, actually, no. It's interesting because with a lot of the traditional melodies, you have many different variants of them. Now, perhaps somebody in Great Britain singing Phoebe will sing it completely differently, and that's the other interesting thing is that because the words and the melodies change from one location to the next, people were want to pick out particular melodies that they liked. With a lot of our indigenous folk songs that were created here in Nova Scotia, we don't have a tremendous history of actually writing and conceiving our own melodies. People would take a familiar melody and rewrite words. So say, for instance, a vessel broke up on the rocks, mm-hmm. and they wanted to write a story of that. And quite often you'll see in the old manuscripts or somebody's scribbler, and they'll say, is this a wreck of the Annie B. Lawrence or whatever, who was wrecked in 1784 or 1895 or whatever. And they'll say, sung to the tune of, and they'll pick a very popular song.
I see, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wish more of our maritime singers would have conceived melodies. But what they tended to do was pass the melodies on from one person to the next, retain them as much as they could. But if the singing styles changed or if the style of the music changed, then they would change it along with it.
Yes, I see, yes. Do you write your own?
Some of them I do, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I enjoy that. Mm-hmm. I find it a challenge. I'm very lazy about it.
But you've harmonized all the songs that you do sing from the collection.
Well, yes, I've arranged them extent, and I've had to edit some of them. I've shortened some of them, and some of them I've put two or three different variants together. Some of them, actually, I've picked, and I don't particularly like the melody, so I use another melody that goes along with the song from somebody else's collection. But what I always try to do is let people know the provenance of the song. If indeed it's sung by a particular person that Helen Creighton collected from, or if it is indeed a Creighton version of the song, or if it's somebody else's version of it.
Let me just ask you again, possibly as an aside, to what extent have you sung? You've sung with your own accompaniment. You've sung a cappella. Have you ever gone beyond that? Have you ever sung, let's say, with an orchestra, or has anybody ever done that?
Well, I've been working in the professional music field now for 23 years. I think I've probably done it all.
So you have sung with orchestra.
With small orchestra, with ensemble pieces, with full symphony orchestra, with my own recordings, with my own albums, with different musicians, whether it be harp or flute or whatever feel I particularly feel.
And you've arranged them yourself.
Yes.
That's great.
Yeah. Now, I haven't arranged the symphony stuff.
Yeah. I was just wondering if you'd sung with symphony with orchestra.
Well, you see, my background is as a performer singer. So I've done all kinds of music, uh-huh. from rock. I've sung with big bands. I've sung country, bluegrass, everything. My background is very eclectic, even to musical theater, which I do quite a bit of. Mm. So I have a very eclectic background, but I always go back to the traditional music, and predominantly the traditional music in the Creighton collection, because that's my first love. I love it all. I love every kind of music, but I have a real affinity for the traditional material. I can really, really lose myself in it.
Yes.
And also feel that it suits me. You also reach a point in your life where you come across a musical style that you feel suits you, and that you can do justice to. And this is one of them.
I think the third one we were going to talk about is the Cherry Tree Carol. You want to say something about that?
Well, it's actually another child ballad. It's a very old. I even hate to call it a Christmas song, because the older Christmas traditions, the older traditions built around the birth of the Christ child, also cover the books of the Apocrypha, which are not included in the contemporary Christian Judaic scripture. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these songs are the wonderful stories of Christ's flight into Egypt, where he goes through and the corn is just coming up in the field, and Christ causes the corn to grow to full maturity overnight, so that when Herod's men are searching for him, mm-hmm. the peasants can actually look Herod's men in the eyes and say, "He was here. Yes, he did go through, but he was here when the corn was just coming out of the ground." There's a number of these other apocryphal stories that deal with the very early childhood of Christ, and of course one of them is the story of the Virgin Mary going into the garden and being very hungry, and having the doubts, having Joseph doubting her when she tells him that she is with God's child. And she says, I'm hungry, I'm with child." And he says, "Well, let the man that got you with child feed you then. I'm not going to feed you, I'm not going to marry you, or you're not going to be my wife." So she goes in the garden, and the cherry trees themselves bend down and feed her. So it's Joseph's proof of that. So again, you have those wonderful stories that paint such exquisite pictures. And when they're brought over to some place like Nova Scotia, you wonder how they're going to be transmitted and how they survive. And this particular version, or a version of the version that I do, is a version that she collected from Mr. Riley, William Riley, who lived in Cherry Brook, which is just outside of Preston, a large black community outside of Preston. And he had a great number of spiritual songs and what he called his rising up hymn, which was a hymn once he felt that he was visited with the Holy Ghost, that it was a very personal hymn to him. I don't do Mr. Riley's rising up hymn, because it's too personal to him. I wouldn't impose upon his his restrictions that way. But I do a variant of his Cherry Tree Carol, because it's an exquisite song, and he was a wonderful singer. His singing style, again, was incredibly different than mine. He would sing it somewhat like, and again, I don't try to do accents, but his he would sound somewhat like, "And Joseph took Mary upon his right knee." He had these all sorts of marvelous twists to it, and nuances that he uses. But I do it in my...
In your way.
In my white Anglo-Saxon Protestant upbringing.
"Well, Joseph took Mary upon his right knee, saying, 'Mary, won't you tell me when the birthday shall be? Saying, 'Mary, won't you tell me when the birthday shall be?' The birthday shall be on that old Christmas night, when the angels in the glory rejoice at the sight. When the angels in the glory rejoice at the sight." Well, Mary walked in the garden just like a little child, saying, "Give me some cherries, for I am beguiled." Saying, "Give me some cherries, for I am beguiled." Then Joseph said unto Mary, "I'll give you no cherries. Let the man give you cherries that did you beguile. Let the man give you cherries that did you beguile." Well, the tree spake unto Mary, and it began to bow, saying, "Mary, gather cherries from the uppermost bough." Saying, "Mary, gather cherries from the uppermost bough."
Right. Thank you.
It's a lovely song.
It's a lovely song. You know, we have we have two programs here. This is the problem now. I mean, it's not a problem, but we really do have two programs. It's a shame to have to use so little.
All you have to do
is
press a button, and I'll just talk ad infinitum.
I mean, this is fantastic. It's
well,
you see, what's interesting is that you're answering a lot of questions that I mean, just by speaking that I tried to ask Helen, which she didn't answer, largely because she doesn't seem to think that way.
That's right.
And she's very, she's very intelligent. She's very sophisticated, but she doesn't think particularly in the global sense about what, or the significance of what she's, or the significance about the songs. In some sense, she just did it. I mean, she's very simple about it. And any attempt I had to ask her about the effect of these things and so on, she didn't really address very much.
That's quite true. Now it's up to us.
Yeah.
To take it beyond its regional scope, and make it more that way. And that's happening, fortunately. There's a number of other folklorists and people that work in the field of folklore and ethnomusicology that are taking the Creighton Collection and doing a lot of the more academically structured analyses of it. There has been Laszlo Vikar from Hungary, a well-known musicologist, has done mode indices to her various songs, and lots of other people have done very, very highly academic papers on aspects of her folklore collection. So Helen's importance to the collection. I recently did an interview for CBC Radio, and they were quite interested in knowing what the most valuable thing to come out of the Creighton Collection was. And the most valuable thing, in my estimation, and Helen and I have talked about this before, is that Helen has saved it. She was there at a time when she had the fortuitous insight, I think, to realize that it was there. and to also realize that she wasn't capable at that time of deciding what was to be kept and what wasn't. So she collected everything. She had that marvelous ability to do that. Quite often the people, her peers who were working with American folklore, had to go out into the field and they had to be very narrow. They had to say, well, all right, now this summer I'm working on Appalachian customs that deal with rattlesnake bites, or this summer I'm dealing with cowboy songs. When Helen Creighton was working for the National Museum of Man, which is now the National Museum of Civilization, Dr. Marius Barbeau said to her, go out, get everything. Get everything you can. And she did.
Yeah.
And now it's up to us to carry on that, I hate to use the cliche, carry on the torch, but really carry it on and make sure that the additional work that needs to be done on the Creighton collection is done. I don't expect to see it done in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. If I devoted my entire life to it, and I've certainly been devoting a good hunk of it, nice. And I expect to devote the rest of it to it, but it will never all be done. It's just too large a collection. It's humongous.
Uh-huh. What about?
Up to us to carry it on. You mentioned the academic aspect. What about the performance aspect?
Oh, that's incredibly strong.
Are there a lot of performers who are going into the archives and using the collection, in other words, performing the songs? And
it's beginning to happen. Mm-hmm. And primarily, one of the reasons that they didn't do it before was that they didn't know its availability.
They didn't know it existed.
They even if they knew it existed, they didn't know how available it was to them, because it was Helen's private collection.
So mind it's only you, been available for 3 years, right?
It's only been available publicly for 3 years, but right. There was never any problem. Anybody that ever got in touch with Helen Creighton, she always gave them access to it. Right. She was very incredibly generous with her material, more generous than most people would ever be. It not only reaches the performer, it not only reaches the academic, it reaches the historian, but one of the most wonderful things that I think happens, it's incredibly moving when you're at the public archives and you see a grandmother and a granddaughter sitting at a tape recorder with headphones on and the tears streaming down their faces because the granddaughter has never heard of this person that the family has talked about. And the grandmother has heard her father's voice for perhaps the first time in 40 years. Mm. And to save that is just phenomenal. Because what you're also doing is going back into the community and saying, not just thank you, Helen Creighton, for collecting the songs, but thank you, Ben Henneberry. Thank you, Catherine Gallagher, for realizing when Helen Creighton came to your door, to open up your door, to make you feel welcome, and to say, I'm so glad somebody's interested in this, and I will give freely and willingly and with such devotion and with such heart. Well, I sang one of William Riley's songs, A Cherry Tree Carol, from William Riley was from Cherry Brook. A couple of years ago, I went over to a junior high school there, and I gave three classes, and the last class I gave was primarily for the students who now live in Cherry Brook. And it was such an education for me, because I was introducing them to a subject that most of them had forgotten about, except when I said things like the Rising Up hymn. They all knew what I was talking about. It was wonderful to go into a junior high school situation, and when the bell rings, and these are normally bus students who, you know, when a bell rings at a school and you have to catch a bus, you're out the door, or else you have a long walk. When the bell rang, they all sat still as boards, and one girl put up her hand and said, can we all stay? And I said, I'll stay here as long as you want to, and played them tapes of people from their community. When you can take that back into the community and tell them, look, you had somebody in your community who gave of his talent, of his genius, of his time, and what he gave has brought pleasure to people all around the world. That's a nice thank you. That's an awfully nice thank you. And that's one of the most important things that the Creighton Collection is able to do. It's able to say to us, sure they were fishermen, sure they were farmers. Yes, indeed, some of them were illiterate, but they were no less wonderful, decent, incredibly bright, intelligent human beings who had something to give. And we're responsible for keeping our culture alive. Fortunately, at the time, we also had somebody like Helen Creighton, who was incredibly bright, intelligent, and talented, who could go around and recognize that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It took some time before this collection became valued. Isn't that true?
Sure. It took a long while for her work to be as recognized as it was. Yes. There was a good many years that Helen told me in the early times that if it wasn't for the devotion of her family and a few close friends, she would have given up. Because there's certainly no monetary value to it. When you consider that you go out and collect for her early years, where she'd go out and collect for 2 and 3 years at a time, and maybe she'd get $20 for an article that she wrote. That small reward. People tend to think that because she's a writer and because she's so world famous that she's an incredibly wealthy lady. And that's one of the things that the school kids always ask me. They ask me how old she is, how is she, did she write Farewell to Nova Scotia, and is she rich? I always tell them how old she is. I always tell them how she is, how well she is. No, she did not indeed write Farewell to Nova Scotia, and I say she is incredibly rich. Not financially, but she's incredibly rich, as we all are because of the work that she did. You can't measure it in dollars and cents. The singers didn't. Her informants didn't. None of her informants ever said, "What's in it for me? What will I get from this?"
And Helen's the same way.
Sure.
No, it's,
sure.
Yes.
You have to be, or else you're making the stuff cheap, and it's too valuable to do that too.
Do you yourself? You said you presented a paper at a university. I'm sorry, I
no,
missed
actually, it.
No,
actually, it was during the Lunenburg Folk Festival.
During the Folk
and
Festival,
and I presented a paper in Lunenburg.
Are you also a scholar? I don't.
I hope to think so. Yeah. Not. I'm not a trained. I do not have a degree in folklore. I've studied folklore at university, and I think I have a very, very strong background in folklore. And my other university training, aside from folklore, is in the costume and textile end of it. So I have a good theoretical research background as well. But quite a few years ago, I was talking to the man that heads the department, or headed the department at Memorial University in Newfoundland, and I was seriously considering going over to study folklore. And he said, "You're a fool if you do. Why would you leave Helen Creighton's side?"
To study folklore somewhere
yes,
else. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Why would you say, "No, thank you, Mr. Beethoven. I think I'll go and take piano lessons."
What is your involvement in costumes and textile? How does that relate to your interest in folklore in general?
I'm involved in the folkloric aspect of mm-hmm. costume and textile, and people's beliefs and in how they feel that the symbolism and the cultural aspect of it. But I'm also very interested in that part of it. I think it's a big part of our cultural background. But I'm also just I love the tactile end mm-hmm. of and the visual end and the social history of it. I also do a lot of making myself, you know, I'm a weaver I have a university degree in that sort of thing, so I am
that
very
must
much
mean something.
Well, no, it doesn't. That's the whole ticket. That is the whole ticket. It's like Helen has 6 doctorates.
Right.
They're all honorary.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually had somebody quite a few years ago. It was actually a CBC interview, and somebody. They're not working for CBC anymore. I think this is reflective on how the interview went. They said, "Now, is she a real doctor, or are those just honorary degrees?" And I at that time she had only been working in the field for 55 years. And I said, "Well, how important is it that it be a real doctorate? What you consider to be a real doctorate?" And that's the way I feel about the work I'm doing with the Creighton Collection.
Sure.
Why would I go away? It's the grass is always greener. People very seldom ever say to me anymore, "Oh, you shouldn't be here. You should be up in Toronto. You should be down in New York." Why would I want to be doing traditional Nova Scotian folklore and live in Toronto or New York?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense.
Do you think there's any more collecting to be done?
Yes. Oh, tremendous amount.
How so? Is it now some? It's not something that's been missed exactly by Dr. Creighton, but how do you see collecting going on?
Well,
now?
Again, with the contemporary aspects of folklore that yes. I talked about, that will always go on, and we are doing that even with the space program. We're collecting aspects of folklore and folk beliefs, whether they be in how we pass on, again, the process of oral transmission, or whether it be customary example. An exciting venue that I would love to see more of being done, and actually it's starting to progress, is I would like to see people doing some follow-up to the Creighton collections. One of Helen Creighton's best informants, in that he has had a wonderful voice and still has a wonderful voice, is still a wonderful singer, and is perhaps somebody that you should try to see, is Fred Redden, who lives in Middle Muscadobit. Fred was an informant of Helen's in the 50s, and his daughter, Finvola, who's also a wonderful singer, she also sang songs for Helen. What's interesting now is that just last year, and in fact it's an ongoing project, Jamie Morera, who is at the Memorial University in Newfoundland, he's doing a recollecting of the Fred Redden material. And it's fascinating to see, after 30 years, how much his material has changed. Just his own material has changed. And he's collecting songs that Helen Creighton didn't collect from Fred. And we're also able to go back and say to one of her informants, now, what was it like being an informant of Helen Creighton? There's tons of interviews with Helen Creighton, and they're all valuable and they're all exciting, but there's not that much with the few remaining informants or the families of informants. Yes. What it meant to have that come in, what it means to the families of informants to know that their father or their grandmother or whatever has a song published in a book.
Yes.
Those kinds of things. Yes. And to go back, I was very interested. Most of the material I did for my talk on witchcraft in Lunenburg County came from the Creighton Collection. I certainly extracted some other material, but most of it did come from the Creighton Collection. I was interested in going back to find out how much of that material was extant, or if there was some additional witchcraft material, or if indeed some of the cultural aspects of witchcraft in Lunenburg County had changed so drastically that I wouldn't recognize it as being part of something that was collected in the Creighton Collection. So there's a tremendous amount of work to be done.
Mm, I see. Do you have assistants that you work with? Do you work with other people on this yourself?
At times. Most of the time it's pretty well a solo thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And most of the time with the Creighton Collection, it's because I do it because I want to.
Mm-hmm.
I was very lucky that I had a salary for 2 years at the public archives.
Yeah.
But I've always been self-employed, so I know what that's like.
Right.
I'm very lucky. The Creighton people always say to me, "Oh, you're doing so many wonderful things with the Creighton Collection, and it's so great." And I feel like I'm doing some good work with the Creighton Collection, but I also feel incredibly humbled to be able to work with it and to be able to make a living at it. It's an incredibly wonderful opportunity for me. I have it a lot easier than Helen did. Because I'm a performer, people will pay me to perform the material, or people will pay me to go and lecture, or people will pay me to give a university course, Introduction to Maritime Folklore, or whatever. She didn't have that opportunity.
Right.
She had to do the legwork.
Yes.
So she's made a career for me.
Another gift.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I thank you for talking to us.
It's been my pleasure.
Very enjoyable and very informative. Thank you.
It's easy to talk about something that you love.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Thank you.